Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With the June 5th California primary fast approaching, we are reminded that 50 years ago, Senator Robert Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles on June the 5th, 1968, just after winning the California primary, which made RFK a shoo-in to become the next president of the United States. We will begin with Tom Jackman, the Washington Post reporter who covers criminal justice, and discuss his article at the Washington Post, "Who Killed Bobby Kennedy? His son, RFK Jr., doesn't believe it was Sirhan Sirhan." Tom's article is based on extensive conversations he had had with RFK Jr. after it was revealed that RFK's son had visited Sirhan Sirhan in prison before Christmas last year and had spent 3 hours in private conversation with the 74-year-old man convicted of assassinating his father. We'll discuss the efforts of Paul Schrade, the UAW union organizer who was shot in the forehead by Sirhan Sirhan, to reopen the case because of his belief that there was a second gunman standing behind Kennedy who fired the fatal shots. This is a conviction also shared by RFK Jr., who believes the wrong person has been convicted of killing his father, then the chief law enforcement officer in the country, who RFK Jr. feels would not have wanted to put someone in jail for a crime they did not commit. Then we will speak with the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the new book, The Common Good. We will discuss how societies and nations undergo virtuous cycles that reinforce and build the common good, and conversely, we have vicious cycles, which we are now suffering under Donald Trump's misrule, that undermine it. But there are optimistic signs emerging from the young high school students in Florida to the many women running for elective office, indicating that the Trump nightmare may soon be over. Then finally, with Trump slapping 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, punishing America's closest allies, Canada, the EU, and Mexico, we will look into the implications this has for the looming trade war with China and speak with Scott Kennedy, the director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who is just back from 3 weeks in China. The author of Beyond the Middle Kingdom, he joins us to discuss how alienating our allies while issuing hollow threats to China isolates the U.S. and makes us weaker. And joining us now is Tom Jackman, who has covered criminal justice for The Washington Post since 1998. He was the lead writer for The Post Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the 2007 Virginia Tech shooting, and he's the author of Rites of Burial, and he has an article at The Washington Post, "Who Killed Bobby Kennedy? His son, RFK Jr., doesn't believe it was Sirhan Sirhan." Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Jackman.
Hi, Ian. What's going on?
Well, what's going on here is, of course, there's a lot of anticipation of next Tuesday's June 5th primary here, and the airwaves are blanketed with politicians slamming each other and sliming each other. But it does make
That's
one—
That's every day here in Washington.
Of course, yes. You're in the swamp, I know.
There you go.
But it does remind you that 50 years ago, on June the 5th, just after having won the California primary, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated at the Ambassador Hotel here in Los Angeles, and that was, what, 4 years after five years after his brother, President John F. Kennedy, was shot, and not long after Martin Luther King was also assassinated. So that's the context. But last year, I guess, was it around Christmas that Robert Kennedy Jr. met with Sirhan Sirhan, who was in prison for having been convicted of shooting Bobby Kennedy?
It was December 19th at a prison outside of San Diego, where Sirhan has been for several years now.
And while Bobby Kennedy Jr. met for 3 hours with Sirhan, while his wife, the actress Cheryl Hines, sat outside in the car.
Right. I'm told, actually, by the lawyers that she wasn't in the prison parking lot, unlike what Bobby told me. She was actually, I guess, had to stay at a motel or someplace nearby because she wasn't authorized to be on the grounds. She wasn't part of the interview, so she wasn't right outside the gate.
So you spoke with Bobby Kennedy Jr. about his meeting with Sirhan Sirhan, but let's start with who set it up and why, and what prompted Robert Kennedy Jr. to meet with the convicted assassin of his own father.
Okay, well, there's a fellow named Paul Schrade, and Paul Schrade was standing behind Robert F. Kennedy at 12:15 a.m. on June 5th, 1968. He was a laborer and civil rights organizer for the Kennedy campaign, and he was hit above the forehead, sort of halfway up his scalp, by a bullet that knocked him down but didn't go into his head, knocked him down. And four other people who were standing near him were also hit by bullets in the front of their bodies. Kennedy, who was standing a few feet to the right of Paul, was shot point-blank, contact wounds in the back of the head and in the back. And so that very fact has driven Paul, since 1974, to seek a new investigation of this case. And he implored Bobby Kennedy Jr. to come visit him and look at some of this evidence. And so Bobby Kennedy Jr. told me, how could I refuse, knowing this guy's history with our family? He had worked with Bobby Kennedy since at least 1960 in the convention that helped elect his brother John. And so Bobby Kennedy Jr. did go visit Paul Schrade, I think it was more than a year ago, and received the autopsy report that was done by the famed Los Angeles coroner Tom Noguchi, and he looked at other reports, and he then went and spoke to people who were there that night, who are still around 50 years later, and he then decided, after speaking to those people, I've got to go see Sirhan. And now this Kennedy is a lawyer, and he's an investigator, and he's an author, and so this was a somewhat logical next step to sort of look this guy in the eye and see if there was something to this claim that, yes, Sirhan fired his shots, but he didn't fire the fatal shots into RFK. And he came away convinced that Sirhan is wrongly accused of killing his father.
And, of course, it was his father's last words, was it not, that after he was shot, Bobby Kennedy said, "Is everybody okay? Is Paul all right?" And
right.
Paul Schrade had been called out by him, I think, on stage at the rally.
That's exactly right, Ian. Very good. Yes. He had said, "I want to thank one person in particular. You know, Paul Schrade really pulled together the labor vote in this state." And Paul Schrade flashed a peace sign, and Bobby reached over and grabbed his two fingers. And you can see this footage in this new Netflix documentary, Bobby Kennedy for President, has that.
And Bobby Kennedy said to you, "I was disturbed that the wrong person might have been convicted of killing my father. My father was the chief law enforcement officer in this country. I think it would have disturbed him if someone was put in jail for a crime they did not commit." So what we don't know, and what you don't know, and what I, well, maybe you did, but did Bobby Kennedy tell you anything more about his conversation with Sirhan?
I pushed him on that several times in several different calls, and he was very careful. And the only thing he would say was something to the effect of, I'm looking for the exact quote, in the 3 hours that I spoke to him, he didn't say anything that contradicted anything he's been saying for the last 50 years. Here it is. "In my conversation with Sirhan, he said nothing to me that contradicted what he said for the past 50 years. And what that is that Sirhan has said, I remember going to the ambassador, I remember being at the ambassador, I remember talking to a pretty girl in a polka dot dress, and then the next thing I remember is being tackled by all these people. And I don't remember the shooting." And that is what he has said from the start. And I guess that's what he told Bobby.
Right, but there were others that were there that do remember the shooting, right? And he was
That's correct. He
was grabbed with the gun in his hand and tackled. So he did fire a bunch of shots, did he not?
He fired 8 shots, but those people almost uniformly say, they all say, really, that after he got off 2 shots from several feet away from Kennedy, Carl Uecker, the maitre d' of the hotel, grabbed his wrist and slammed it down onto a table. And so he never got to a point where he could have been behind Kennedy and putting his gun against Kennedy's head. And there are a number of other people who are right there other people that worked at the hotel, people in the Kennedy campaign, witnesses, who all say, no, he's on that table. He's down. And he continued to fire, even though his wrist was being held. He was still able to squeeze off the rest of his shots, which is where those other people get wounded. But he was never able to put his gun against Bobby Kennedy's body. That's the almost unanimous view of every witness that was there.
And, of course, you mentioned the autopsy report that Paul Schroeder gave to Bobby Kennedy that got his attention. It makes it clear. Thomas Noguchi basically said there's no way that Sirhan could have fired those shots because the bullets that killed Bobby Kennedy, was within an inch or an inch and a half just behind his ear. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Noguchi actually spoke recently at a conference in Pittsburgh, and he said, you know, we took a similar gun and we fired it at 1 inch, 2 inch, 3 inches away to see what kind of powder burn it would leave. And we decided that that gun was 3 inches behind his head, 3 inches away. And then there were the wounds to the back of his coat. The gun is right up against the coat. I mean, the hole is small because it goes right in and the powder burn is right there on the coat. You can see it. Then there were four shots that hit him. One of the shots went through his shoulder pad and didn't hit his body, but it did go through his coat. So four quick shots from behind.
And these shots were recorded by a Polish journalist, were they not? And they were able to count 13 as opposed to 8 shots.
That was the capacity of
Sirhan's revolver, only had 8 shots.
That's a good point, and that was a tape that the person who made it at the time didn't realize that he had recorded it. He was in the ballroom where the speech was, and there's actually video. You can see this journalist from Poland. He's on the platform, and then when Kennedy leaves, he goes up and detaches his microphone and equipment in 1968, and he's got one of those newfangled cassette recorders. And he accidentally turns the microphone back on and starts recording again and inadvertently captured the shots that are in the kitchen pantry, which he is walking toward. And there's video, you know, the networks had kept their cameras rolling on the platform, and there's video of this guy leaving the platform, and you can see practically where he is as he approaches the pantry. And so using technology that wasn't available in 1968-69, a guy named Phil Van Praagh, an audio engineer now living in New Mexico, found the shot impulses on that tape and found 13 and possibly more. He said, you know, when the screaming happens, it's hard to figure out if there's any more. But he thinks pretty much there's 13, but he would say any more than 8 means there's absolutely a second gunman, and he believes that there were.
And apparently there were bullet holes found in the metal frame around the pantry door, I guess.
The wood frame, that's
wood
right.
Frame, yeah.
There were, and so there's photos of cops looking at this. There are cops who said, I saw those holes in the frames, and those were absolutely bullets in there. And there's been an explanation given by the LAPD that, well, those were holes that had been put there by, you know, service trays or rolling carts that had hit the doors over the years, and the hotel employees saying, oh, no, that's not true, that those holes weren't there before. And then none of that was questioned in the trial because of his incredibly bad defense. And then the LAPD destroyed all of that when the trial was over.
And the lead crime investigator, the LAPD, Dwayne Wolfer, has been criticized subsequently. There apparently was an internal LAPD document that concluded that Kennedy and one of the other people, the ABC reporter who was shot, Wiesel, the bullets were not fired from the same gun. Then Schroeder's always been felt, from what I understand from conversations I had with him years ago, was that the likely culprit is the security guard, Thane Caesar, who was right next to Kennedy. He was armed, and he also hated Kennedy's. He was a follower of George Wallace. He disappeared to the Philippines, where he's free from extradition, is he not?
You know, that's a good question about extradition. I would think we might have an extradition treaty with them, but he's definitely on the other side of the world. He didn't go there for a long time. He did remain in L.A. for a number of years after this happened. Several interesting things were that, one, he was supposedly armed with a .38 that night as a security guard. He was in exactly the right angle to shoot Kennedy, but the bullet holes are not .38 caliber holes. It's definitely smaller caliber. Well, they took a .22 out of Kennedy, but he owned a .22. This security guard, Thane Eugene Caesar, owned a .22, and nobody ever looked at it. Nobody checked it. Nobody checked his .38, the LAPD. They just sort of let him go. And he claimed, Caesar did, that he had sold that gun before the assassination. Well, it turned out when people dug a little deeper that actually he sold it after the assassination, and his political views came out, and people wondered, well, where's that .22 now? And it took a fairly circuitous route to Arkansas, where it was dredged out of a pond, and somebody owns it today. I'm not exactly sure who, and it hasn't been tested or compared against the Kennedy bullets.
So just in closing, Tom Jackman, Paul Schrade wants a trial. So does Bobby Kennedy Jr., does he not?
Sure, absolutely. He wants them to investigate. They want to try to figure out who the second gunman was.
And what do you think the chances are?
Slim to none, honestly. But there are groups like the Innocence Project who have resurrected cases from the grave, hate to use that bad metaphor, but I mean, I guess nothing's impossible, but there was, you know, this case went through the U.S. court system for 40-plus years until finally there was an order in, like, 2016 saying no more filings in this case. So they are attempting to go to an international court, the Inter-American Human Relations Court, hoping for a hearing there, but I don't know that that would have any effect on Sirhan and his future.
Well, Tom Jackman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. It's good talking to you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Tom Jackman, who has covered criminal justice for The Washington Post since 1998. He was the lead writer for the Post Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the 2007 Virginia Tech shootings and is the author of Rites of Burial. And he has an article at The Washington Post, Who Killed Bobby Kennedy? His son, RFK Jr., doesn't believe it was Sirhan. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, about his new book, The Common Good.
Last week I had the strangest dream, where everything was exactly how it seemed, where there was never any mystery of who shot John F. Kennedy. It was just a man with something to prove, slightly bored and severely confused. He steadied his rifle with his target in the center. Everything we need, and I will care for you, cause you care for me, and we all have opinions. Some of them get through, but there's better people with more good to do, good to do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Reich, who's the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, the founder of Inequality Media and chairman of Common Cause. He is the co-creator of the award-winning film Inequality for All, and his latest film out now on Netflix is Saving Capitalism. And he's the author of 15 best-selling books, the latest of which is The Common Good. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Reich.
Well, thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Robert. And your book makes a case for a more generous, inclusive revival or rediscovery of the American experiment, centering on our moral obligations of citizenship. And I must say, what happened yesterday with the president tweeting out his anger at the chairman of Disney, Bob Iger, for apologizing to Valerie Jarrett for the horrible racist tweets that Roseanne had sent in her direction, likening her to the mating between the Planet of the Apes and the Muslim Brotherhood, but no mention whatsoever of Roseanne's racist comments, but rather a kind of petulant complaint to Iger saying, how come you apologize to Valerie Jarrett and not to me for all the awful things that have been said about me on ABC? I must say that it feels like another Charlottesville moment. So is there any way that we can have a moral awakening here in this country when we have such a moral vacuum at the top?
Well, let me be an optimist for a moment, if you'll let me, Ian. I think, actually, that Donald Trump has inspired so many Americans to rethink basic values, to say to ourselves, well, we can't take for granted any longer the norms and values of this country. We've got to fight for them. We've got to make sure that the Constitution is not just something we pay lip service to, equal protection of the laws. We've got to make sure that tolerance and decency are things that, again, that characterize the America we want. We can't just sit back. And I think that, you know, ironically, historians may look back on this era and say this was a turning point because Americans had a chance to see during the era of Donald Trump what a dystopian fantasy, which is not a fantasy any longer, what it might be like to live in a world in which people make racist comments, fuel racism, a president who actually not only fuels division among Americans, but also has no respect for the Constitution, for his own office as president, doesn't even understand the importance of preserving democracy. I think that, actually, and maybe I'm looking through rose-colored glasses, Ian, but my book is all about what we used to, in this country, talk about a great deal. We didn't always achieve it by any stretch of the imagination, but we at least talked about the common good. It's kind of an antiquated notion now, but it wasn't just individualism. It wasn't just getting ahead by any means, making as much money as possible by any means, accumulating political power by any means. It actually took account of some norms, some values, some constraints, some understanding that we're all in this together.
Well, I suppose there is a silver lining in what happened yesterday with ABC firing Roseanne. And in your book, The Common Good, Robert Reich, you talk about how the notion of leadership should be considered as a trusteeship in corporate America with much corporate executives, and they should recognize responsibilities beyond maximizing profits. Well, ABC did the right thing. It seems as though Starbucks also, a couple of days ago, all of their stores did some sensitivity training in terms of dealing with African-American customers as a result of an appalling piece of racism. And again, we have these examples, but in those two cases, corporate America stepped up to do the right thing. And it would seem that, you know, Roseanne she's finished, is she not? So there is some sense in the country about what is right or wrong, it would seem.
I think that's right. You are right, Ian. I think the country does have a strong moral sense of what is right and what is wrong, and people don't want the president or Roseanne Barr or anybody else who is prominent to misuse their prominence by sowing racism and division and hatefulness. I think we've had it with all of that. And ABC, well, we could look at Starbucks and ABC and say, well, cynically, they did it because they had to. Their corporate image was at stake. But I think, and I would like to think, there's something more at stake, and that is that they understood that as major players in this country, they have an enlightened self-interest in standing for the right values.
Well, I think they must recognize that the broader population has these values. my sense is that, and your book points it out, that there are these cycles that societies and nations go through, these virtuous cycles that reinforce and build on the common good, and the reverse of which, of course, is that they go through vicious cycles that undermine the common good. And arguably we're in a vicious cycle with a president who is at war with both the law and the truth. And he, after all, revived racism with the Bertha conspiracy that led him to political prominence, frankly. He essentially gave people permission to come out of the shadows and be racists. And it feels now that the tide is turning back towards the better angels.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, the truth itself is a common good. It's something that we took for granted. I don't think most Americans before Trump understood how fragile the entire system of truth is. After many times, we have been lied to by the government. I mean, certainly in Vietnam, with the Vietnam War, and then later on with a number of instances leading up to weapons of mass destruction. I mean, it's not as if the government always told the truth, but we were, as a nation, appalled when the government lied to us. And I think that the notion of a systemic, consistent set of lies coming out of the White House is something that has sensitized us to the importance of again, the truth. You know, Ian, the idea of the common good, it was once widely understood. It was once widely accepted. I mean, the United States Constitution, after all, it was designed for we the people, seeking to promote the general welfare. It wasn't designed for me, the selfish jerk, seeking as much wealth and power as possible. I mean, during the Depression, a decade of the 1930s, and also during World War II, we faced, as Americans, common perals. They required us to work together for the common good. And I think, in a sense, in a way, Americans have taken for granted. We've got away from that sense, that understanding that we are all interdependent, we're dependent on one another, that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And I think that what we're going through now may be a reckoning of some sort.
And Robert Reich, we're getting close to the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert Kennedy. You started out your career working in the Senate office of Robert F. Kennedy, did you not?
Yes, that was my first job in 1967. I was an intern. I was starry-eyed. I was just so excited to be in Washington and to work in the same office as Robert F. Kennedy. It was not my own job was hardly a particularly important job. In fact, I ran his signature machine for months. I didn't even see him, and he didn't even see me. And so one day I was standing in the corridor of the Senate office building, and he came out of an elevator surrounded by his aides, and he looked at me for a moment, and he said, "How's the summer going, Bob?" I mean, the fact that he knew my name blew my mind. I think I would have run his signature machine for another 6 months at that moment if he had asked me.
So he had that magical appeal that transcended the divisions that are now in the Democratic Party, in the sense that he, both on the progressive wing and on the kind of more conservative wing, white-collar workers adored him, minorities adored him. You recall the funeral train that brought him back from Los Angeles to Washington. People, all walks of life, lined the tracks, honoring this man. Do you think that the coalition that Kennedy built could come back, could be rebuilt?
Well, I think it has to come back, Ian. I mean, middle class and lower middle class and poor whites have a huge amount in common with middle class and lower middle class and working class and poor blacks and Latinos. And that's the coalition that we need in order to make the economy work for everybody and in order to make our democracy really responsive to everybody. It is too much. I mean, Bobby Kennedy, if he were alive today, would be appalled at the extent to which our politics and our economy have basically fallen completely under the aegis of the very, very rich, the big corporations, the CEOs, Wall Street, the billionaires. I mean, Bobby Kennedy would say, not that these are bad people, but he'd say that we need a renewal of democracy in order that the system can work for everybody, that everybody can have an equal opportunity. He was able, as you suggested, he was able to bring the white working class together with blacks and Latinos and others to forge a coalition that I think is the only way out.
So in terms of your book, The Common Good, essentially, it's an invocation for us to get more politically engaged and to rediscover civics. Of course, civics are no longer taught in schools. And you're calling for a greater degree of engagement both with the citizens, with their government, and the government with their citizens. And it seems to me that this idea of maybe a good place to start is what you suggest, which is to start with both civic education and 2 years of mandatory public service to make us both understand that we are citizens and that we have a stake in this country. I think the alienation in this country explains Trump's success as a populist, being able to beguile and manipulate the alienated people in this country into voting for him when he's absolutely going to take them to the cleaners, which he already is. You can't dismiss, and I think we have to deal with the deep well of alienation in this country, surely.
And that alienation is something that Trump exploited, and he transmitted a lot of that anger and frustration that so many people have who are not making it into racism and into xenophobia, fear of foreigners, and into even misogyny. I mean, a lot of what Trump stands for is a very brutal view of the relationship between men and women. Let's not forget, Donald Trump has a history in all of these respects. You know, what we have got to do, and what I talk about in the book, is a new conception of patriotism that's not based upon securing our borders or standing for the national anthem or being in a very superficial way a kind of the American flag wavers. It's based upon a deeper notion that real patriotism depends upon sacrificing for this country, paying your taxes, doing public service, doing what so many young people have done over the years in terms of really putting their lives on the line for this country. It means bearing a part of the responsibility for keeping this country going and also bearing a responsibility for pulling people together rather than splitting us apart. I mean, those are all aspects of true patriotism. And what I try to do in the book is give people a roadmap as to what we need to do and how we can get this back, how we can recover this essential moral foundation for this country. And it is a moral view, and I don't shy away from that word.
Well, but surely the first step has to be, given the political moment, which is depressing on a daily basis. We're being whipsawed by government, by stunt, by a president who should never have been elected, who clearly doesn't know what he's doing, who's deeply cynical, and as I mentioned earlier, is at war with both the truth and the law, and the law is closing in on him, and he's getting more and more desperate. It is an appalling situation, and it's unprecedented, and it would seem that our urgent task at the moment is, in terms of the November election, is to do what we can to limit the damage this man is doing. And as far as I can tell, the only recourse we have, or at least the first order of business, has to be the November election, surely.
Yes, the first order of business has got to be to vote in a Congress that will stand up to this man. The second order of business, though, is to deal with the conditions that led to Trump being elected. Widening inequality, the deep stagnation of income, the frustration and the alienation of so many people. And of course, part of that also has to revolve around the 2020 election, making sure that there is an alternative to Trump that inspires people. I mean, I think it may be too much to ask that we have another Bobby Kennedy. I don't see a Bobby Kennedy on the horizon, but there are good candidates out there, and we shouldn't make this just merely a partisan Republican versus Democratic issue, because it goes much deeper and much broader than that. We need a new generation of leadership that is going to put this country back in contact with its founding principles. I think we will get there, Ian. I want to be very optimistic about this. The young people that I come across as I travel around America are probably the most engaged and inspired and idealistic young generation I've come across since the anti-Vietnam War movement of the late 60s. Look at those high school students in Florida in terms of their eloquence and their ability to lead and shame adults into really being adults and acting like adults. I'm also inspired by the extent of the grassroots movements around this country, partly in response to Trump. I mean, more women are running for office now than have ever run for office before. You've got grassroots groups all across even red America who are getting involved, getting people involved in politics for the first time in many of their lives, to the point where they understand that citizenship and what we owe one another as citizens is not simply only paying taxes and doing jury duty and basically voting. No, it's about engagement, involvement, taking our responsibilities as citizens seriously, and creating a country that we all want rather than a country that we feel deeply alienated from.
Well, in the last couple of minutes then, could you leave us with an invocation? Because I think the book is really a roadmap in many ways to how we can begin. We talked about the first order of business is to vote. But I think on top of that, the first order of business is to get active and get the vote out, and not just your own vote, but everybody else you can think of. And on top of that, of course, as you said, the second order of business is to understand why we are in this position and offer alternatives. And I don't see a lot of that happening, and I do believe, as you mentioned, the people that are rising up, the young high school kids from Florida, the women who are running for elective office in huge numbers. The deficit that the Democrats have had for the longest time has been an enthusiasm gap, and I don't see an enthusiasm gap there. I think that there's a natural majority, and people are fired up, and they're just ready, I think, for the right message, and they should get your book. What more can you add?
You asked me for a little bit of a benediction or an invocation. Let me just say, Ian, that we've never been, this country has never been, obviously, a perfect union. But our finest moments have been when we sought to become more perfect than we had been. Bobby Kennedy is a perfect example. I mean, we can help restore the common good by striving for it and also by showing others it's worth the effort. I worked for Bobby Kennedy a half century ago when the common good was well understood. Resurrecting it may take another half century or more. But let me just leave you with the words of theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, because he once said, and I'm quoting him here, "Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history," unquote. In other words, we've got to do what we can do. If we don't, history will fault us. But if we do, each of us does what we can do for this country right now, at this time of great need, then we can take satisfaction that for our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, we were there and we acted.
Well, Robert Reich, I thank you very much for joining us here today and for your new book, The Common Good.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Reich, the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He's the founder of Inequality Media and the chairman of Common Cause and the co-creator of the award-winning film Inequality for All. And his latest film, out now on Netflix, is Saving Capitalism. A best-selling author of 15 books, his latest book just out is The Common Good. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing the 25% tariffs that Trump has imposed on our closest allies, Canada, the EU, and Mexico, while a trade war with China looms.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and the Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and is the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, and his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Good to talk with you.
Well, thanks, Scott. And you're just back from a trip to China. And so what's the mood over there as a trade war looms between the Trump administration and China?
I was in China for almost 3 weeks and traveled to several parts of the country. And I think there's kind of a dual mood. One is sincere concern about what the U.S. may do in terms of tariffs and other penalties vis-a-vis China and others and what that means for global trade. I think the other feeling, though, is that it's hard to know when to believe President Trump's threats and take them seriously because he seems, from their mind, to be changing his position quite a bit. And so there's this other sense that one, you can't give in, and two, you need to work on your problems aside from thinking about the U.S. and this and a potential trade war.
So the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, is going to China, and it looks as if at this point the $50 billion tariffs on Chinese goods, that's still on the table, right? The war looms unless – and what we've got about a month, haven't we, before the hammer drops?
Well, according to the statement the White House released just a couple of days ago, if there's not enough progress on issues that were part of the 301 investigation and the trade deficit on June 15th, the U.S. will implement tariffs on that $50 billion worth of goods, and on June 30th, implement restrictions on Chinese investment. I don't think that's what the White House wants to do. It seems to me that, yes, it's possible one side of the White House is up and the other down now, the hardliners versus the softliners, and they're just going back and forth. On the other hand, it also seems the president is speaking to a domestic audience and trying to reassure Congress and the Pentagon that he's pushing on China, and so that whatever Secretary Ross comes away with from his visit this coming weekend to China, the president could potentially credibly say that his renewed pressure on China was responsible for getting those concessions, not that he wants to actually implement those penalties.
Right, but there's a total inconsistency, is there, with being tough on China at the same time, being leaner, being giving a break to the Chinese telecom company, that Trump himself said he was worried about them losing jobs, which, of course, a lot of people were pretty amazed about, since Trump ran on the idea that the Chinese were taking away our jobs. And there's lots of reports that there may be a connection between bailing out the Chinese telecom giant, who the Pentagon considers to be a back channel or a back door to Chinese intelligence. And the rumor is that there's a link between a $500 million loan that the Chinese bank gave to an Indonesian company in business with Donald Trump. So in China, I know they don't have an open press there, but is there any sense, did you get, Scott, that the Chinese think that maybe this is a president who could make side deals to the benefit of his own family and family company, opposed to being the champion for the United States?
I think everyone in China that I've spoken with, of course, just like everyone here in the United States, is trying to figure out what motivates this president. What's the core underlying logic of his policies? Is he a trade hawk at heart? Is he more of a negotiator who puts out a high price and then settles for less? Is he just looking for attention? Is he just looking for deals for his personal business? These are the basic options. And just when you think you've got one view nailed down, something else happens. I thought from last July up until the middle of May, it was pretty clear that President Trump was acting as a trade hawk on China and was consistently preparing for a trade war and was going to go through with it. But then signed that framework agreement on May 19th with the Chinese that looked like he was letting them off the hook. And now, just a couple days ago, it looks like they're back on the hook. I think there's so much shifting, and none of these shifts seem to be really entirely connected to a clear overall policy. There's so much ambiguity and uncertainty that I don't think we can really assign one clear logic to this that explains everything. And I think you have folks in China just as confused as you have folks here in Washington, D.C.
So today, the EU Trade Commissioner, Cecilia Malmström, said, "Today is a bad day for world trade." And what she's referring to is that the Trump administration's announced that it will impose new duties on steel and aluminum products from three allied trading partners, the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. There's also an implication that in doing so, this is adding more pressure on the NAFTA negotiations as well between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Mexico is about to have a presidential election. There's no way that a Mexican president is going to appear weak before being bullied by Trump, who keeps insisting that the Mexicans are going to pay for this ridiculous wall, which they have adamantly saying no to. This has reached the point where the Republican senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska says, quoting, "This is dumb. Europe, Canada, and Mexico are not China, and you don't treat allies the same way you treat opponents. We've been down this road before. Blanket protectionism is a big part of why America had a Great Depression. Make America great again shouldn't mean make America 1929 again." What do you make of that?
There's some truth in the words of the senator. I think that's a quite important statement. And, the administration is showing that it's very good at breaking stuff, not necessarily good at building stuff. And you need a global economy to operate in a healthy environment where the rules of the game are strong and followed. And you just don't chuck out the baby with the bathwater, because it's a very important baby, the global trading system that we have. And I think, looking at this from the perspective of U.S.-China relations, one of the critical ways to move China off of some of its more egregious industrial policy tactics is to work with our allies and friends around the world who face the same challenges with China, in China and in their home markets and in third markets. But by leveling these penalties against everybody else, as well as raising the possibility of tariffs on automobiles
and God knows who what might come after that. You can't have an allied front against the Chinese, that gives the Chinese even more reason to dig in their heels, and because they don't think that this will leave the U.S. isolated, not the Chinese, because China's got sympathy, given how the U.S. seems to be treating others. So this is important for not only the global trading system, but also for how you're going to mobilize and deal with the Chinese on issues that are genuinely problematic.
So in other words, our closest allies, Canada, and Trudeau, by the way, said today, he's obviously outraged, you know, he said, we've been America's closest ally for 150 years, you know. I'll quote exactly what he said. "Let me be clear, these tariffs are totally unacceptable," said Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. "For 150 years, Canada has been America's most steadfast allies." So if you're going to stiff your allies like Canada, Mexico, and the EU, what you're saying is that you're actually they're going to be more sympathetic to China, even if China is stiffing them.
Sure. I mean, you're going to if you need to take tough action against the Chinese to deal with industrial policy, you can't do that unilaterally. You have to do it in combination with your allies and friends all together through the WTO or other institutions. They are much less likely, in fact, very unlikely to stand shoulder to shoulder with the U.S. on China issues when the U.S. treats them this way. We're doing the exact opposite of what we ought to be doing with them. And that's why, you know, TPP had such amazing potential, not because each line of the text was written so sparklingly, but because it created new rules of the game with 40% of the world's GDP as part of those rules, and offered was put before, you know, the Chinese would need to change policies to join. And so we're giving up our ability to shape the global rules of the game and work with our allies in a way that would change the playing field that China operates in. You know, when you want to negotiate with the Chinese, it's oftentimes best not to negotiate with the Chinese and work with your friends and allies and through international institutions. We are giving up, the U.S. is giving up a lot of the key levers that it could use in this fight, and just simply digging unilaterally, putting pressure on the Chinese and is not going to, in and of itself, be the solution to our problems.
Well, apparently in these trade talks, and I'm not sure whether it was with China, that the divisions within the U.S. team were just ludicrous and obvious. They're apparently Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury, and he's allied with the new fellow from television that's now...
Mr. Kudlow.
Yeah. Kudlow, right. And on the other side, you got Navarro and Wilbur Ross, I guess, and Lighthizer, the trade negotiator.
Yeah.
And apparently, Mnuchin and Navarro were having a screaming match in front of the Chinese. Was that reported in China?
I don't know if the Chinese press has reported that. Certainly, Chinese have heard of that and they would have seen it. From what I understand, most of that trip that occurred in early May, the American delegation interacted with each other pretty amicably, and I don't know if that is reflective of how the delegation really was the entire time. I think everybody in the delegation wants, and the administration wants, to figure out a way to constrain Chinese industrial policy because they know it's damaging. The question is how to actually get there. But I do think it is reflective of the fact that, although it's not that there are disagreements, every administration has that, is that what is the procedure for arbitrating these disagreements, not just amongst the top principals, but within each of the departments and through the interagency process. And so when you don't have a fully functioning interagency process and a system of arbitrating differences, then those type of disputes somehow get played out in ways that can be quite embarrassing and give the other side the impression that you're not a unified camp and give them more reason to not make concessions.
But that's not to say that these divisions don't exist between the Mnuchin camp and the Navarro camp, and it looks as though Trump is favoring Navarro over Mnuchin.
I would say yes. There's a wide variety of opinions, perhaps along the lines that you just cited, and I don't think that I think administrations oftentimes have a whole variety of views within them. I think, again, what we have is not, we don't have a clear system in this administration for adjudicating those disputes, and for once those disputes are been resolved in one with one side or the other. In this administration, it seems that one can go back and forth depending on what day it is or what month it is. And it seems that we've done an about-face a few times on our China's trade strategy recently. And that makes it doubly hard to get anything done because you're not sure what purpose you're working towards. And so I'm sure frustrating for those in the system, for those on the outside like you and me, watching it and then trying to explain it is also not an easy task.
Right, but this is not the kind of Abraham Lincoln team of rivals notion that you have of a wide variety of opinions. The way I see it is that the Navarros of this world are indulging Trump's ignorance because he has these ridiculous ideas and all kinds of conspiratorial ideas that he embraces. I mean, as much as I dislike Mnuchin, after all, he put thousands of local Californians out of their homes onto the streets and made a fortune out of it. But nevertheless, at least he's dealing with rationality as opposed to dogma.
Yeah, well, certainly I will grant you that Donald Trump is no Abraham Lincoln, and that difference affects the way this administration runs, and that he has a motley group of advisors who have differences in terms of their backgrounds and their temperament, their views. That I think that's reflective of the type of the way he ran the Trump organization. That may work in running a small family business that's financially quite large, but still run like a family business. It's different than when you're running the world's lone superpower. It's a challenge. I think that generally it would be good for the United States to have a clear and consistent policy, one way or the other, hard line, soft line, for expanded trade and globalization, for industrial policy, for penalizing others. I would favor the latter, the former over the latter, but something is always better than wobbling back and forth between many different things. I think the U.S. now is in danger or has already sacrificed a good deal of its credibility in what it says. And so if it's hard to know if you're the Chinese or some other opponent out there, when is the U.S. threat real? When is it simply bluffing? And that inability to distinguish between those things means that on just about any issue, not just trade, but security issues, which are matters of life and death, quite difficult to deal with. And that's what I'm even more concerned about than the specific trade issues that we are dealing with right now.
Well, Scott Kennedy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good talking to you.
Thank you, Scott. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy, who's the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and the Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and is the author of The Business of Lobbying in China. And his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.